Without further ado, just to introduce Rabbi Brander, we had a brief bio of Rabbi Krug, Rabbi Dr. Krug, as well as Dr. Blumenthal. Rabbi Brander is a man whose description and bio says nothing compared to his accomplishments. He's the dean currently at the Center for the Jewish Future, named so by Richard Joel, the president of Yeshiva University. He's a rabbi emeritus of the Boca Raton Synagogue, a place which is quite dear and fond to my heart. He's the founder of the Weinbaum Yeshiva High School. He oversaw community's explosive growth from over six in about 14 years, from 60 families to 600. He helped establish two satellite communities, a personal shamus of Rabbi Salvechik, a founder of the Boca Raton Community Kollel, ordained at Yeshiva University, and received special ordination as well at Machon Pua in the field of medical ethics, infertility, and gynecology and halacha. Currently, he is a PhD candidate in FAU, Florida Atlantic University, and for all he does for the Center of the Jewish Future and for modern Orthodoxy throughout this country and throughout the world, it is my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Kenneth Brander, along with, as you have met already, Dr. John Krug and Dr. Norman Blumenthal. Thank you so much.
I want to begin by first thanking all of you for coming today, and it's really a pleasure to be here, especially a pleasure to be here with Dr. Norman Blumenthal and Rabbi Dr. Johnny Krug. For those of you who have had the opportunity to hear both of them today, Dr. Blumenthal, who is a world-class mental health professional, interacts with the REIT students on a regular basis, not only in the work that he does with the Wexner Kollel, but the work that he does in particular teaching pastoral psychology to the new rabbinical students. And although I did not have the opportunity to take his classes when I was in Smicha, the feedback from his classes is really first rate. It's a pleasure to be here with him. And to be here with Rabbi Dr. Johnny Krug, who was one of the reasons why so many of us got involved with Jewish communal work. Many years ago, when I was a student at Yeshiva University, I was involved with the programs that I'm now actually charged to promote. And we had certain role models of what it means to be an effective educator, what it means to be a creative educator. And the person that really represented that was Johnny Krug. And so to even be here on the panel with him is a real privilege. I too want to thank Rabbi Levi Mostovsky for the work that he's done to make today possible. I want to take the pleasure of welcoming a member of the REITS board who's here also, Shel Bellows, with his wife and his family. It's a pleasure for them to be here and to see the work that they support in so many different ways, in addition with their perhaps the most important support that they do, and that is that their son is a major player in sharing the vision of modern Orthodoxy, of a Torah model with Hafila Orthodoxy, with hundreds of students, both on the YU campus as well as around the country. And Acharon Chaviv, the real pleasure to be here today is to see your rabbi and Rebbetzin, Rabbi Shannon and Tzipora Gelman, who I've had the opportunity to work with and to learn from during my years in Boca when they were members of the Kollel. It's really, you guys have the special privilege of having such a jewel within your community. I hope you appreciate that. I hope you protect it and use it properly and allow them to lead. And please God, you will continue to grow from strength to strength. So it's truly a pleasure to be here today. The topic that we will talk about, and I'm just going to give the introduction and let the people who really know this stuff deal with it and answer the questions. The topic is priorities and perspective, community, family, and life in general. And the specific focus that I was asked to talk about and to perhaps give some halakhic overview on is the sandwich generation issue, the balance between, as adults, dealing with parents, dealing with children, and dealing with spouses, caring for elderly parents, dealing with children at home, and nurturing our relationships with our spouse. And this challenge of being the cream in the Oreo cookie and not exactly sure where the cream should exactly land, on what side of the cookie, on the one dealing with our elderly parents or sometimes empowering our children, is a pervasive challenge within American society, so much so that Rabbi Mostofsky, in putting together this program, arranged on the front cover of this week's U.S. News and World Report. They focused on the program in this shul, Taking Care of Mom and Dad, A Boomer's Guide. So Rabbi Mostofsky, Rabbi Gelman, Kol HaKavod, you finally have learned marketing properly. And it deals with the issues that we need to deal with. It deals with the issues that 19 million Americans care for somebody over the age of 75, and that our homes are beginning to serve as long-term care locations for over 75% of the elderly. And Baruch Hashem, as our parents are living longer, the focus is on independence. It's no longer about being nice to your child because he picks your nursing home. It's about being nice to your child because he picks which room in your house, in their house, you will live. And if it's not about them, it's not about elderly parents living at the child's home. It's about assisted living, warmer and smaller environments, using new technology, and the practice of checking up on the elderly as they live more independent lifestyles. However, this is a topic that I feel comfortable speaking about, not as a mental health professional, which I am not, but rather speaking from it from a very personal perspective. Because for several years, my wife and I had the privilege of my father-in-law living with us in our home. And that was had a lot of positives to it. First, the most important positive was I found out in the beginning of the first of the many years he lived with us that if I had a discussion with my wife on an issue in front of my father-in-law, I always won. And therefore would postpone any conversations about anything to a dinner table where my father-in-law was present. So, for example, if we wanted to discuss about, you know, should we go to Israel for the summer? My wife would say, you know, we shouldn't do it. We should save more. And I would say, you know, we should do it. It's important the kids should be in Israel on a regular basis. My father-in-law would turn to his daughter and say, Ruchi, you know, Kenny, you should listen to what Kenny has to say. Maybe we should go to Israel. It's not a bad thing. It worked like a charm. Unfortunately, after his passing, I was relegated to losing every battle, but for those few years, it was a good situation, to the point in which my wife refused to discuss any issue in front of my father-in-law for fear that she had violated kibud av va'em for disagreeing with me. But the bottom line is that it taught my children the notion of kibud av va'em, not by fancy lectures, not by chakiras, and, you know, the whole notion of what kibud av va'em is based on the Gemara's and Kedushin, on Daf Lamed Amad Aleph, etc., etc. And it required much sacrifice. It did require sacrifice. Our time was no longer our own. And when we figured out how to deal with having, at that time, we had four children at home, how we deal with that and finally had time for us, we had almost another child at home who was my wife's father, and we had to deal with that. And we had to work out family time. We had to work out the fact that we, towards the end, there was always an aide in the home, and therefore a communal rabbi has limited privacy to begin with, especially when even in one's own home, in those moments at night, you had to make sure that you were, you know, fully dressed in a whole bunch of different ways because you always had additional personnel within the home. And there were many times in which my father-in-law would travel through his life. I will never forget the nights or the afternoons or the late evenings in which he thought the Nazis were coming to take his family away, and he demanded that we turn off all the lights in our home. Try explaining that to your 3-year-old child or to your 7-year-old exactly what's going on. And when he started to fall, reconstructing the house to remove all the steps in the home so we would obviate that challenge. But with all of the challenges, and then, you know, and I'm articulating them without prejudice. It was an unbelievable and very special experience, not one that I wish my children will ever have to go through, but it was an experience in which we truly felt that we had fulfilled a responsibility, and as much as we gave, we truly felt that we had grown through the experience as a family and as adults. And so there is this tension between the responsibility of kibud of the aim, of honoring our parents, focusing on our spouses, and having responsibilities to our children. So for a few moments, I'd like to just share with you a few sources, share with you the tension that I feel is found within halacha, and then allow the mental health professionals to help resolve some of that tension or discuss that tension, but to recognize that there is that tension within halacha. So if we could look at the blue sources, for those of you who have, hopefully that's all of you. Have they been distributed? Yes, they have been. And you're going to get one right now. Okay? And that is, starts with the Gemara and Kiddushin, where the Gemara says the following. I'll just read the English. Rav Asi had this elderly mother. Once she told him, I want a jewelry. He then went out to buy jewelry. And then he said, well, I want a husband. And he started looking for a husband for his elderly mother, at which point he said, I want one as handsome as you and as young as you. And what happens is that Rav Asi decides to leave her and to move to Eretz Yisrael, even before Nefesh B'Nefesh, and what happens is that he comes to Eretz Yisrael and then hears that his mother's coming to Eretz Yisrael, is thinking about leaving Eretz Yisrael. But the bottom line for our discussion here is that he leaves his mother and moves away because he can no longer handle the challenges that his parent is facing him with. Mm-hmm. That in itself is a challenging piece of text, to the point where the Rambam, on source number 2, reminds us about the responsibility of kibud av ve'em, where the Rambam tells us, in source number 1, we have underline, with one line, and that is, how much is kibud av ve'em, even if your parent takes a pocket, a bag full of gold, and throws it into the ocean, you can't complain about that. Even if your parent, if you're sitting up in front of your whole congregation, and your parent comes over to you and tears your clothing or spits on you, you cannot complain about it because of the responsibility that you have to honor your parent. But nevertheless, Rambam also reminds us that while a child has a responsibility to honor a parent, even in the most challenging of situations, a parent cannot demand too much respect. A parent cannot put his or her child in a compromised position. But here's the halakha that is really what I want to point out to you. It's the one with the asterisk right by it, and source number 2. Mi shenitrafa daito shel aviv o shel imo. If a parent becomes mentally challenged, what are you supposed to do? Mishtadeli nehog imahem kifi datam ad shiruchem aleihem. Try to the best of your ability to help them until one has mercy upon them, which can mean many different things. Ve'im e efshar lo la'amod mifnei shenishtatu biyoter yanichem v'yelech lo v'yetzaveh acheirim lahanigam koroi lahem. And if you can't take care of your parent anymore because it's too difficult, you have the right to appoint others, a good nursing home, a good living care facility, to do the job for you. They become your shliach and the notion of kibud av ve'em. And the Rambam is predicated, and the Shulchan Aruch Paskins the same way, is predicated on this Gemara and Kiddushin that we just mentioned. The Ravid is upset about the Rambam's psak. The Ravid says, Amar Avram, Ein Zuhara Nechona, the Rambam's not correct here. You don't have a right to appoint somebody else to do this job for you. All of the commentaries attack the Ravid on this issue. The Ram, the Mishnah Melech, the Kesh, the Mishnah, a whole bunch of others. We Paskin like the Rambam. The Nishmat Avram actually brings a source, which I'm only bringing actually because the individual who is quoted in the source, one of the great rabbinic personalities in medical ethics issues, Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Woldenberg, just passed away earlier this week. It's appropriate to mention this was one of the pillars of medical ethics. And he writes about the following. What happens if one has to restrain one's parent? They're living in your home. You have to restrain your parent. You have to tie them down. Are you permitted to do that? Rav Woldenberg says at that point, you basically should opt like the Rambam and find somebody else to take care of them. And Rav Neuwirth, who is the author of the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa, says you're allowed to do it. You're allowed to restrain a parent. But the challenge here is, again, about the fact that when one has a parent that has significant challenges, physical or mental, and you cannot no longer handle them, the halakha does allow you to appoint a surrogate to take the role. This idea is also highlighted if we turn to the next side of the same page, sources 4 and 5, and that is that when I feed my children, that's not an issue of tzedakah. That's an issue. I have a responsibility. I bring a child into this world. It's part of my halachic responsibility to educate my child, to take care of my child's needs. Beis Din can force me to do so. Jewish court can force me to do so. The question is, when I take care of my parents, is that an obligation that needs to come from my financial earnings, or can it come from my tzedakah money? And here the Shulchan Aruch and everybody says, I'm just bringing one example, we don't have time to go through it in great depth, says, source number 4, Zeh shemachilo mashkehu mishel av ve'ein, when you help your parents, it should come from their assets. If they have assets, it's their assets that should be used to feed them, to clothe them. It does not have to come from your assets. When we redid our house to accommodate my father-in-law, he paid for those additions. And the additions that we made to other spaces that were not relevant to his living there, we felt it was our halakhic responsibility to pay for them and not to take it from his assets. However, says the Shulchan Aruch, that v'in eim la'av v'yesh l'bein, the father has no money, but the child does have money. Then you can force the child to spend his money or her money to help a parent. But the halacha is that that money can be considered money of charity. So if I give 10% away or so to charity, taking care of an elderly parent is part of the tzedakah money that I can give away. And I have a right, actually, to give money for that before giving money to any other institution. If I have to help pay for my parent to be in a nursing home or some type of living facility or additional care in the house, and my parents don't have that financial wherewithal, I can pay for it, but it can come out of my tzedakah money. That's what all the poskim say. It's a pervasive opinion amongst the poskim. There are 20 tshuvas on this issue, and they all, the Chassam Sofer has a tshuva on this issue, a whole bunch of others have a tshuva on this issue. My point of saying this, and then I have one other point, and with that I'll conclude. My point of saying this is that we see three different issues so far. We see two. There's one more I want to mention. There is a responsibility to take care of our parents. Kaved avicha v'esimecha. We have that responsibility. But we also have the responsibility to recognize the fact that halacha puts limits on that responsibility. And if we can't handle the responsibility, and I want to make it clear, it doesn't mean that it just changes our schedule a little bit. It becomes impossible to deal with it. It becomes difficult to deal with it. Then we have the halachic right to appoint a surrogate to take a role. The second thing that I wanted to mention is that while it is a halachic responsibility to spend all of our money to help our children, and tuition has become, in the Jewish community, a form of birth control, unfortunately, it's important to recognize the fact, and there's no teachers that are becoming rich off this, and there are no heads of schools that are becoming wealthy over this, and schools are still struggling. We've got to figure out another way of dealing with how to fund schools. It's a different discussion. But the bottom line is, it doesn't come out of my tzedakah money. The only part of my tuition that can be considered tzedakah is if it costs, let's say, $10,000 to educate my child, and the school charges me $12,000 because they're using the extra two to pay for somebody else's scholarship, maybe that too can be considered tzedakah money. But every penny that I spend to help my parents is considered halachically tzedakah money. So now it's deductible in the heavens. Maybe not in, I don't know about the IRS, but it's deductible in the heavens.
You better be careful what
okay.
you write to the IRS.
Right, but the bottom line is that the final piece that I want to mention is, so we see a difference between our responsibility to our children and responsibility to our parents. But we also have to understand that halacha sometimes recognize the fact that sometimes there can be a tension between our responsibility to our spouses and our responsibilities to our parents. And when there is that tension, halacha reminds us that our first responsibility is to our spouses. And the responsibility to make sure that we have healthy family relationships, healthy relationships between husband and wife. And that's found in the Shulchan Aruch, source number 5. Well, the Shulchan Aruch says the following: Homer le'ishto, if someone says to his wife, "Ein ritzoni she'yavo le'beiti avicha v'imecha, arvich v'imech," I don't want your parents coming to my house. I don't want your brother and sister coming to my house. Shomim lo, the wife has to listen. V'tiyeh hi holechet lahem, but she should go to them. Kishe'ira lahem davar, when something happens, when there's a special occasion, there's a party, there's an anniversary, someone's ill. And minimally, she should go to the parents' house at least once a month, and every holiday. And they are not allowed to visit the home unless she is sick or she's given birth, which means that she can't visit them. Now, this does not only apply if the husband makes the demand. It also applies if the wife makes the demand. V'chein hi, she'amra, I mean, she says, Ein ritzoni she'yavo lebayit avicha v'imecha, I don't want your parents in my house. I don't want your sister, your brother in my house. I don't want to even live in the same block as them, right? Because they just give me problems. Shomimla, you have to listen to her. Now the Rama puts a condition on it, but at the end the Rama also says that you listen to her. The point being that there is a tension within halacha regarding these three issues. About this being the cream in the Oreo cookie. About the recognition of responsibility to parents versus responsibility to children. A tzedakah responsibility versus a direct responsibility. Focusing on one's spouse and nurturing that relationship and recognizing that if there's a tension between spouse and parent, the spouse and that relationship is considered more significant. So, is there a tension? Yes. Does halacha resolve the tension? It should not. It recognizes that you need to play that role. And the way that we dealt with that tension, finally, was not something that we figured out the first day that my father-in-law moved in. And thank God it wasn't something we figured out only 5 minutes before he was no longer with us. But we realized the following. And with this I conclude. We realized that sometimes you are the cream in that cookie. And you recognize the fact that when you're with each other and you spend the night or you spend time together and you go out together, you don't feel guilty that you're not with the parent you're supposed to take care of. And when you're with your family and you're taking vacation and you've arranged a schedule so that your father-in-law is being taken care of, but you're not dealing with every single point, and therefore you feel that perhaps it's not happening the way you would choreograph it to happen as well, you don't feel guilty about the fact that you're not with them at that point in time. You feel good about the fact that you're with your family and giving the proper family time at that point. And when you're helping out an elderly parent, you don't feel guilty that you're ignoring perhaps somebody else in the equation. You recognize the fact that ultimately that our challenge is to recognize that we have to sometimes divide ourselves into parts, recognizing that we don't live in silos, but recognizing that sometimes we have special focus, and recognizing that halacha realizes this tension, and it does not give us an easy path, but recognizes the different challenges and reminds us about the tension that sometimes can happen as we live mature lives as adults with multiple responsibilities. Thank you.
Moderating, right?
Okay, so
thought that what we would do is we'd ask both of the panelists here to share words on this issue and then take some questions.
You can use my distinguished colleague. I feel like we're the I'm Torquemada and this is the Inquisition up here. But just to take what Roy Brander said, just a half a step further in how we can prepare ourselves now, and really for all of life, what Roy Brander was actually alluding to is something very interesting, which is called a role conflict. In other words, all of us at any given point in time are playing multiple roles. Life is very easy when those roles don't come into conflict. So, for example, I'm a husband to my wife, I'm a father to my children, I'm a son to my aging father. I'm a son-in-law to my mother-in-law. I'm a teacher to my students, I'm a psychologist to my patients, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, as long as I'm sitting here in Chicago and we're talking, no problem. Things are great, things are fine, there's no role conflict. So what if my cell phone were suddenly to ring, and I glance at it, and I see it's my wife? I now have a question before me. How do I resolve this conflict? Do I become husband to my wife, she's calling me, or do I remain part of the tribunal up here and stay with the people in Chicago? So I have to make a decision. So if I pick up the phone to my wife and I say, I can't talk to you right now, I hang up, I have made that decision that my place, my time, my role is here. My wife calls me, she says, okay, I just want you to know the main in our house broke. We have 6 feet of raw sewage in our basement. I go, bye, choing, and I'm out the door. In that case, in terms of the role conflict, it was settled some other way. The more roles one plays in the sandwich generation Rabbi Brander was talking about, and this idea of being the cream of the cookie, no matter what you're doing, which is the last point that Rabbi Brander made, you're not doing something else. So the stress, the tension, typical situation, the parents retired to Florida, and you're up here in Chicago, and you are a mother or father to your children in elementary and high school, but you're also a child to your aging parent in Florida, and they're now ill. What do you do? Do you go there and become the dutiful child to your aging parent and assume that role? Or do you remain the parent to your children and assume that role? Whichever one you choose, it means you're not doing the other one. It's the old story about the tie, that when Menachem Begin met Sadat for the first time, he gave him a tie. When they met the second time, he gave him another tie. When they met the third time, Sadat was wearing one of the ties, and Begin looked at him and he says, you didn't like the other tie? So it is this conflict that we find ourselves in. And preparing to try and resolve, and what strategies you have, what tools you have, what defense mechanisms you have, in order to invoke that resolution to that role conflict. Because as long as everything is fine, we don't have anxiety. Psychology tells us that anxiety is a symptom that is being generated by our body, just like pain is a physical symptom. Anxiety is a psycho-emotional symptom that's generated when we feel we can't handle something. Our body lets us know that by generating this little thing called anxiety. And one of the ways to anticipate how not to have, or certainly to reduce or handle that anxiety, is to practice the strategies of role conflict resolution before you get to that point.
Could you explain role conflict resolution?
Yeah, it's when you have conflicting roles to fill, and how are you going to bring about some kind of answers to which one do I do and how do I do it?
I'll say one thing quickly, but I think we want to hear from the audience. I get my voice back. There's a new initiative that's being done nationally, which of course we've been doing for thousands of years. It's called learned helpfulness. Some of you may remember that if you took Psych 1. There was a whole theory called learned helplessness, which was a theory that predominated the field. But now we're doing learned helpfulness, and they're finding that in many schools when they make as a requirement of schooling. Now we're talking about in public schools. We're not talking about in yeshivas. That they require people to give or to extend themselves, to do chesed, which has always been a part of our lives, that the whole psychology changes, their attitude changes, there's less depression, there's less anxiety, there's actually better schoolwork. That we don't look at giving, and that whether we're giving to parents, spouses, or children, as getting used up. It seems that when we give, we somehow generate more. It's a little bit like a nursing mother. We generate more, and we have more. So I just wanted to maybe throw that into the hopper, too, as we talk about these kind of necessities to extend ourselves to so various different people. Sometimes you'd be surprised how much we have to give. So let's see, go ahead.
Let's say the wife has parents that need to be cared for. for, and the husband has parents that he's daycare for. Mm-hmm. Who, if halacha dictates which set of parents you're supposed to care for first? Not sure.
You guys want to try to answer that question?
Logically. Well, when I was the Rambam,
I don't know of any sources on that issue, so I'm not sure I'm answering it correctly. But to the best of my knowledge, there's a whole set of literature about responsibilities to in-laws also. That's a form of kibud av aim also. And there's a machlokas in the poskim whether that's true or not. But clearly the husband has a responsibility to his parents, and the wife has a responsibility to her parents. And I would assume that the best way to work that issue out is to see where the best care could be for all, and hopefully figure out a way that you can resolve that challenge in a way that one can do a service both sets of parents. In focusing on something that Rabbi Dr. Krug said earlier, and as someone who was a rabbi in Florida for 15 or so years, this issue of dealing with children who had parents in Florida was something that came by my desk on a very regular basis, to the point in which my mother used to give out, we had two phone numbers at home, the standard number and a one that was not listed. So when my mother's friends would call and say they needed help on this issue, my mother would say, yeah, you can call my son at home. Here's his private number. So at one point I told my mother, she gives it out again, I'm not giving her the number. That wasn't a great kibud av aim thing, but it was a shalom bias issue. But the bottom line is that there were many times in which I saw a couple that were challenged with the fact that both of their parents were dealing with challenging situations. So in cases in which one had a more acute challenge than the other, most of the time both children would work. In other words, the husband and wife would work on that case a little bit more actively, and at the same time would help the other set of parents that maybe the case was not as acute. And as you are aware of, as well as I am, there's a whole new cottage industry that has opened up in Florida of individuals who are social workers who now become... have clients, and their clients are the children that live in places like Chicago and New York and the entire, area around here, where they become your shliach to watch your parents, so to say, when they are vacationing in Florida, or those that start vacationing and they get to a point where they don't leave Florida and live there full time. So I'm not really answering the question fully, because I'm not sure that there is a complete answer, but I have found in the cases, in a practical way, in a transactional way, that when there's been those challenges, you look at what the most acute needs are, where the bekuach nefesh issue is more significant, and you deal with it. And there's been times in which I've seen couples come down and they visit their respective sets of parents in various hospitals, and they deal with that challenge. Any other questions?
I have a question. I'm up in the transition age, where my 45, 41, and 39-year-old children do not accept that I am no longer 45, health-wise, because I have a syndrome. And one of the books about the syndrome is You Look Well, But. It's called Sjogren's Syndrome. The children do not accept, they refuse to accept that I'm not the same person I was when I was 45, 35. I was playing tennis 6 days a week. I don't know what you can do in this situation. I'm in a transitional phase of my life.
Dr. Good would like to answer that question.
Couple of answers. That I think are relevant. we have a tendency, number one, to lock our parents in with certain images. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these images are blown up in our faces or wrested away from us, as in wrested. And there are certain points in life where you recoil in horror. For example, for a little kid, the parent is absolutely invulnerable, immortal. Daddy can do anything, mommy can do anything, and you can make, mommy can make anything better by giving it a little kiss. Come, let me kiss, it'll be better. And the kid comes over, has a skinned knee, you kiss him on the forehead, and it's all better. This magical, this fantasy land that children live in is one day blown out of the water. When you go to daddy with a broken vase, because daddy can fix anything, daddy can make anything better, and you come with these broken pieces, and the kid goes, here, fix it, and daddy goes, I can't fix that, it's smashed. Whoa. Eye-opening moment of life when you realize that there is vulnerability. Sometimes it's introduced in a very traumatic way. God forbid a parent gets sick. And I'm talking about with little kids, the parent gets sick. One of the issues, by the way, that I found in my research with Holocaust survivors were anger by kids at their parents, because when the Gestapo kicked the door in and forcibly took mom and dad away, the kids were mad at dad for not being able to protect them. It sounds illogical, but it's psychological. One of the problems that kids have is we have our parents locked in, and we don't want to let go of that image of them being healthy and robust and the guide. And what we find with adults is that the love that an adult child has for their aging parent is much less intense but much deeper than a child has for their parents. So love is very intense because you need dad and mom so powerfully to invoke that salvation that I talked about in the first session for those of you who were with me. But the love becomes much more mature and much deeper later on in life. But the little child piece that exists in all of us, as we grow up, the object of the game is to become adult. So I'm a little child, and as I grow, the percentage of child drops and the percentage of adult rises. But the theory will tell us that no adult hits 100% adult. There's always this tiny little piece of child within us. You could be 80 years old, and you're in Florida, and you're about to walk into a McDonald's, and a little voice comes thundering out of the past. You should not be doing that. That's the voice from our parents. It's the little child in us that is still feeling that. So the question is being raised now. Which piece of us as little child is hanging on to that idealized image of the parent as the robust? They'll always be there for you, and it's a very rude awakening. It's one of those eye-popping moments for children, 45 and 50-year-old children in that sandwich generation where, God forbid, when a parent dies, but you're next. That generation, that buffer in front of you is gone, and you're next. So the kids who are 45 desperately attempt to hang on to that. The other notion is we're living in a society, unfortunately, where young equals good and old equals bad. It's called ageism. It's a prejudice against old age. And the multi-billion dollar industry that we have in this country to keep young. The fact is that death is the next inevitable stage of life. And most mental health professionals will tell you that we don't quite get there, because if we develop healthily throughout life, we're ready for death, because it's the next inevitable stage that every single person in this room is going to hit at some point. Ad mea v'esrim, but they're going to hit it. So part of that is our inability to cope with that notion, and we avoid that by not wanting to deal with it, but there needs to be some kind of realistic approach to getting it done. And now Dr. Blumenthal would...
I agree with everything Dr. Cruz said.
That's part of it. We can continue about later, but that's part of the answer about doing a realistic approach to helping your children go, and they're having to confront some of the realities that we do not want to confront, the realities that we do not want to confront, and therefore we engage. As they once said, denial is more than just a river in Egypt. And a lot of people are engaging in denial as their way of coping with the way of coping something.
All three of them?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah?
But between your grandchildren,
yeah.
I mean, I think your first responsibility is to your parents, then to your grandchildren. I think that's the point where the machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid starts to really position itself. In other words, the Rambam basically gives you, and there are different people that look at the Rambam differently. The Rambam gives you, says to you, that if you're at the point in which it's too hard for you to do it, you can appoint a messenger to do it for you. The Ravid says, hold on here. Not so fast. You can't appoint somebody else to do it for you. You should really do it yourself. The question then becomes, there's a gray area, and there are some that try to say that the Rambam and the Ravid are not really arguing with each other. That really the Ravid is saying that the Rambam is the next step in the Ravid. In other words, you really should be doing it for your parent, helping them, but if it gets to a point where it's just impossible, the medical requirements, the psychological requirements are too overwhelming, then the Rambam kicks in. And there are others that say no. There are others that say, and I think that this is getting to the point, where that you have the right to make pick somebody to take the role for you, and allow you to be able to then free up some of your time to do other things. But I think clearly, from a priority standpoint, a halachic priority standpoint, the responsibility of a grandparent, besides the fact that there is the notion of, you know, b'nei banim harehin kabanim, it doesn't always translate into halachic responsibilities. If a parent does not circumcise his child on the eighth day, it's not the grandparent that can force the circumcisions, it's any Jew that can enforce it. My point being that in a purely halachic context, it would seem to be that your first responsibility is to the parent, and the second responsibility is to the grandchild. Again, I think that's what Dr. Krug was mentioning before. It's easy to talk about these issues when they're bifurcated. It's much harder when they come together as such. It would seem to me that if there was somebody else, and I think that this is the part where community plays a significant role, and it was nice to see some of the stuff that Rabbi Gelman is doing regarding creating this community outreach piece, and that is that, you know, community can play a significant role in helping here. And that is, it can play a role in making sure that there's an appropriate chesed infrastructure there so that when someone's on bed rest, there's someone to help them. I think it's harder to play that chesed role dealing with an elderly parent. So if you were able to basically find a way to make sure that your daughter, during the time in which you need to be with your parent, was also being taken care of, it would seem to me that your first responsibility in that case, when your daughter has a support system, she has a husband, she has others, there's a community, it would seem to me that your first responsibility would be to the parent. If...
I'm sorry. Please. I was just going to say, as the only member of the panel who was not masochistic enough to become a rabbi, let me just mention that I think I know from
we're giving him honorary smicha next week at the course that he teaches to rabbis as he encourages them to all become rabbis.
All right, okay, got it, okay. No, but seriously, I know from my own experience talking to Poskim that I think the questions, which are incredible questions, speak to the point, and I'm sure Rabbi Brenda would agree, that every case is so individual. And it's very hard to talk in generalities. And when you start talking about these gray areas, I think the poskim, you know, the rabbis make the decisions on a case-by-case basis. So there would be a circumstance such as yours, correct me if I'm wrong, Rabbi, there might be a circumstance such as yours where one rabbi would say, do this, and then
right,
a similar
true.
One, because of all these circumstances get factored in, they'll say the other way. So, yeah.
As the only non-bearded one here today, I would like to point out that, by the way, a sadist and a masochist can be very happy together because the masochist says, beat me, the sadist says, I won't. So they can be very happy together. The Rav Zatzal, Rav Soloveitchik, spoke about something that I think addresses your question and your question originally also about parents and in-laws, although I did start out my own Sheva Brachos by reminding my wife's parents the famous difference between in-laws and outlaws, and that is outlaws are wanted. It went over like a lead balloon there too. The The Rav, no, it was okay. My father-in-law has a sense of humor surgically removed. No, I'm just teasing. Wonderful. I love him dearly. Seriously, the Rav spoke about the inclination of human nature to take over, and we need to be sensitized to it. He raised a very interesting question as to why you have to say Kaddish or be an Avelus for an entire year for a parent and for other relatives, your spouse, your soulmate, 30 days. God forbid a child dies, 30 days of mourning, what's all that about? And the Rav offered two answers on both sides of the coin, which address the nature of what's called Derech HaTeva, the way the natural life cycle flows. On the one hand, a parent has a special status because they are your creator. Without mother and father, you wouldn't be, and therefore they deserve to be in a different category than anybody else. On the other hand, that's the way the world runs. Grandparents die before parents. Parents die before children. That's the way it's supposed to be. And you might be lulled into a false state and have to be told, no, you have to mourn for 12 months. That's Derech HaTeva. That's the way nature runs. And sometimes we get deluded by the way nature runs. We become complacent and desensitized. So it's there to tell us. The Rav had another interesting answer, though. And that is, God forbid you lose a child. And it's outside of the realm of nature. It's not Bederech HaTeva. No one's going to have to tell you to mourn. You're going to be mourning. You lose your soulmate. Halacha doesn't have to mandate it. You're going to be mourning. So part of this is dealing with the natural cycle of relationships, and part of it, as Dr. Blumenthal says, is being mandated, and we can see from what Rabbi Brander presented, the rabbis wrestled with this on a mighty basis. Because they also, which way do you go in terms of resolving this? And it's a question that has bothered us for centuries and probably will continue to bother us for centuries to come, particularly as the actuarial tables show us that the people are going to live longer and longer, mm-hmm. and we're dying of diseases we didn't die of years ago because we're now living long enough to catch the disease we couldn't catch years ago because we didn't live that long. So we're being faced with some very interesting challenges yet to come. It has good sides. I've been at weddings where all eight grandparents are present at a wedding. It's unbelievable. When I was a kid, I didn't know anybody that had grandparents. So we're looking at positive and negative things and on both sides of the coin here.
Okay. At this point, unfortunately, we're going to have to end. I know we have a million questions. I would like to encourage you, while we have time, while our scholars and residents here are here to answer questions, the next couple of minutes or so, go speak to them personally. Just before we end, and we just announced the Seder for Mincha, and I would like to just announce one thing. If everybody here who enjoyed today's program, mostly this course, the merit goes to, in terms of all the technical work, but in terms of all the background, everything that happened, Rabbi Levi Mostovsky, who's sitting there in the back. I would like to really thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm sorry that you didn't get a chance to hear from Rabbi Mostovsky, but it is his personal wish, and I think we should do so. If you open up this little booklet, you will see that in the back, on the last page, and there are pens available on the back table, is an evaluation form. Please fill it out, just two-sided, a bunch of circles. It's very simple to fill out. Take 2 minutes to fill it out. It will mean a tremendous amount to us because in order to make programs like this and even more successful than they were, we need some feedback. As well, I would like to invite everybody to join us for Mincha in exactly 2 minutes. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so achieving the mile, Rick. What he says is the son's obligation to take care of the mother's parents.
Yeah, because the issue of the son, whether they're considered.
Yeah.
That's the thing I wanted.
Do we have a divider over there? I'm going to ask that women. Oh, no, we move the divider a little bit, and we'll go behind it for now, and then we'll.
No,
that's great.
It's
really great. So
That's how the kids remember me. So I'm kind of like in a sandwich generation. I don't have like something pulling me on the
other side. Oh, that's a big pull. So
you might have a note to them.
So how? I'll be glad to write, you know, it's not going to help.
But just keep taking care of it.
Johnny's not funny.
You know, you listen. You have to kill yourself, too.
I know. Someone, I thought this was going to be a little bit of a responsibility. I have a psychiatrist. Someone else wants to be a psychologist. We have Jewish. And she said, this is impossible.
So that requires some. So you know when the airplane they tell you if you have a child, put the mask on yourself first? There's a lack of oxygen.
It's a fancy schmancy word for the people who are trained to work with the family system. They don't work with individuals. Every individual is looked at as a piece of a larger piece of machinery called family. It's a form of therapy called system therapy. It's based on the work. As a matter of fact, if you would like to take a book out of the library, look for a book that was written by Salvador Minuchin, M-E-N, Salvador Minuchin. Look at any of his stuff and you will find interesting things in there that you can probably incorporate into your own thinking to help bring this, or go to a person who's a systems therapist and a couple of sessions with them. We'll be able to do some fine tuning.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
No, I don't.
And my grandson is just starting. He should be in
the first. He's a freshman. I'll tell you.
Very nice.
Let me give you my address.
I graduated.
I'll give you my
phone
number, okay?
Yes. I saw you went to a Dell 401.
I was up for graduate school, yes.
441.
Yeah,
4109.
Okay, thank you.
I will not be.
I think you're on the wrong side of the fence.
I'm after Tuesday. Call me. I'll
call you. It's all pretty. That's why.
Yeah, I'm going to Baltimore, Baltimore to Washington.
I'll be sure in good shape.
So far, I used to play baseball.
For home.
So you're out of here.
All the
time. Oh, that's right. You're out of here.
Everybody, don't forget your evaluation form. Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed being with you.
I enjoyed being with you.
You know, when you're a widower starving for affection.
Yes, you know, my friend lost her husband 6 years ago. But before that, he had been sick for 10 years.
Oh, my.
With multiple myeloma, which is a bone leukemia.
My wife has a massive heart attack.
It's not pleasant to hear.